This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens.
We have not asked that the rules of the game should be modified. If any, we shall never descend to the German and Japanese level. But if anybody likes to play rough, we can play rough too.
Meeting of the Cabinet, Tuesday, 14th April, 1942. Present, Mr. Attlee, Mr. Morrison, and Cabinet Undersecretary Norman Brooke.
Item 1. The release of whole-time civil defence personnel for war industry. The reduction in full-time strengths, particularly in the civil defence...
In war cabinet meetings, Norman Brooke was a silent witness. He sat next to the Prime Minister, or, if Clement Attlee was deputising for Mr. Churchill, on his immediate right. By all accounts, Brooke was highly respected, kindly, and well-liked.
It was also a part of the scheme that full-time personnel released would be liable to be recalled if heavy raiding.
These are his personal notes, handwritten in a large government-issue cloth-bound book. At the top of the page is a date and a short description of the subject under discussion.
There's an element of risk here.
Below is Brooke's own choice of the highlights of what each man around the table had to say.
We must aim to reduce civil defence by around 30%.
Until now, the only record of the War Cabinet's meetings to be released by the government were short summaries of its conclusions. That was in the 1970s.
With regard to the police...
What we now have is the conversation and argument that led to the Cabinet's decisions. Here the speakers are Attlee and Morrison.
How can they return quickly if the Blitz is resumed?
They'll be asked to serve part-time service. This is the main substitute in ordinary times, recall in the Blitz.
Are we agreed with the proposals?
Agreed, then.
A big moment for me was when we came over a hilltop in Germany and saw the roofs and chimneys of Augsburg in front of us.
Monday, 20th April, 1942.
I think the main thing in all our minds is that the war cannot be finished without attacking the enemy.
Very well, gentlemen, can we make a start, please? Mr. Brooke, please record our admiration of the admirable raid on Augsburg. It shows both the courage and determination with which this daring attack has been pressed home. This is quite outstanding. But Germans will imitate this, don't you worry. They will select vital targets in this country, I have no doubt. We must be prepared.
An enemy attack on Exeter and Bath. Neither have anti-aircraft defence. It was felt by
the British raids on Augsburg, together with their earlier attacks on the medieval Baltic port of Lübeck, did indeed provoke German raids. But instead of attacking industrial towns or ports, the enemy went for historic British cities. The attacks became known as the Baedeker raids, on the assumption that Hitler had used copies of the tourist guidebook to choose his targets.
Home Secretary?
Well, the facts are these. The Bath raid started at 1:27 a.m. It lasted an hour. In all, 480 houses were destroyed and 5,000 slightly damaged. For the two nights of raids, it appears that 148 are dead. It seems likely there'll be 20 to 30 more.
And the effect on our Admiralty presence there?
When military affairs were being discussed by the War Cabinet, the chiefs of the armed services sat around the table with ministers.
The Francis Hotel is out.
A.V. Alexander was the First Lord of the Admiralty, and Sir Charles Portal was Chief of the Air Staff.
Lansdowne were knocked out, and the railway station is still out of use.
A number of Admiralty staff have been made homeless.
Are you going to move some rocket batteries?
We'll inquire, Prime Minister.
And what of Exeter?
41 dead in both raids, 16 seriously injured, 53 slightly injured.
But we must ensure that disproportionate publicity is not given to these raids. So, gentlemen, don't make too much of this in the press. We're hitting them three times as hard and we're inflicting far greater damage. We mustn't give the impression that this is quits. The Home Office communique is a bit too sensational. Tone it down, Mr. Morrison, keep it in proportion. Don't give out photographs.
But we have a dilemma, Prime Minister. We can't let Bath think we're making light of it.
But we must stress that our attacks on Germany are inflicting much greater damage. It's important to avoid giving the impression that the Germans are making full reprisal for our attacks on Augsburg.
These pictures were taken by a German cameraman at one of Nazi Germany's U-boat bases. They take you inside the ships that are carrying on today the traditions of the Skull and Crossbones.
Now, mixed up, I think I'm right in saying, the first attack on a convoy which has been actually reported has been. And I'm right amidst the gun too.
The greater concern to Churchill was the very real U-boat threat to the North Atlantic convoys carrying supplies to Russia. In winter, ice forced the ships to pass dangerously close to German air and naval bases in Norway. And in summer, the convoys had to sail in perpetual daylight. Losses in freighters and their naval escorts were heavy. It was said that the fate of these convoys was the one thing that kept Churchill from sleeping at night.
Monday, 20th April, 1942.
Present, First Lord of the Admiralty, and First Sea Lord and Chief.
The convoy to Murmansk is in, but only 8 ships arrived. One was sunk yesterday, close in, and 15 were forced to turn back. First Lord?
Prime Minister, experience suggests we must expect to lose 20% of merchant tonnage in each journey.
We could give better protection to a single convoy of 25 ships per month. This would halve the risk to the home fleet.
Mr. Attlee?
Let's have a complete study, and the War Cabinet will consider it again.
We are agreed.
Agreed.
Well, diplomatically, the Americans are already pressing for a ceiling for supplies to Russia.
Mr. Eden?
The Americans would prefer that we decide between ourselves what we can send, and then tell the Russians this is all we can manage. Do we have an estimate of Russia's own production and needs?
Mr. Littleton?
Well, the problem is that we can't get information about Russian needs without disclosing our own strategic plans. We shall tell the truth, and they won't.
A convoy at 8 knots will be within range of air attack for 6 to 7 days. The German reconnaissance is very good in this area, and the Chief of Naval Staff believes more may be lost than get through.
Correct.
The question is, therefore, whether or not to suspend the convoys until July.
I suggest we put the risks to Stalin and ask him whether he'd prefer to lose a lot now or wait 6 weeks and get much more through.
Could convoys be enlarged after July?
They could, Mr. Bevin, but the difficulty is to make up the full loss.
Well, we should ask Stalin whether they really are in desperate need.
No, we must decide.
Our duty is to fight our way through and get as much as we can to those who are fighting this fearful battle against the German army.
I recommend that we send this convoy. Tell Stalin all about it and say if losses are heavy in May, we may have to defer the June convoy until July.
Agreed. Very well. And we must press Stalin to send up his heavy bombers to help. Explain the risks, but tell him we're coming.
8 weeks after that War Cabinet meeting, convoy PQ-17 lost 23 out of 36 merchant ships. Cargo that went to the bottom of the Barents Sea included 210 aircraft, 430 tanks, and 3,300 trucks, and 99,000 tons of general supplies. But, as Churchill kept reminding the War Cabinet, Russia was bearing the brunt of the war.
Monday, 1st June, 1942.
The action of the Germans in destroying the whole of the village of Lidice near Prague was discussed, the men being killed and the women and children taken away. Retaliation was considered.
The destruction of Lidice was Hitler's revenge for the assassination of SS General Heydrich, Hitler's viceroy in German-occupied Czechoslovakia. Churchill had already met the exiled Czech leader, Eduard Beneš.
I've had a conversation with Beneš about the possibility of reprisal for the savage cruelties now being practiced by the Germans in his country. It was suggested that we could wipe out German villages by air attack. 3 villages for every one they've destroyed. If this is thought worthwhile, let's give the RAF discretion to fit it in when they can.
Is the accuracy of the reports about Lidice beyond doubt?
The Germans have announced it. Sinclair?
I dislike the idea. It represents a diversion of effort from our military objective. Not to mention risking aircraft and crews. And would we not be led on to simply do it more and more?
I very much doubt if it is useful to enter into competition in fretfulness with the Germans.
Home Secretary?
Well, I'd like us to consider the effect. If we strike, there may well be reprisals on English villages, where there's no shelter and a very low level of air raid precaution. I just think that the public would be bound to say, why did you draw this down on us?
Portal?
If they came in low and not far inland, then they'd run a very small risk.
There might be a deterrent element in this.
The German responds to brute force and nothing else.
The view of Bomber Command is that 100 bombers would be required for a low-level attack. Two-thirds should be incendiaries. They'd need bright moonlight. I think that our objectives and reasons should be announced afterwards.
Churchill clearly wanted a harsh response to Lidice. At the time, it was one of the most shocking Nazi atrocities of the war. 3 German villages for 1, he says.
Prime Minister, it might lead to even greater atrocities in Czechoslovakia.
I agree. The danger is that it costs us something and them nothing. I'm against it.
My instinct is strongly the other way. Mr. Eden?
Clearly, the strongest argument against is the waste of a moonlit night.
Yeah, we have to ask ourselves, why attack a village? Why not a quiet residential town? And then where?
Prime Minister, the operational argument against action is very strong.
Very well. I submit, unwillingly, to the view of the Cabinet against.
Yes, as Brooke's notebooks show, there were hawks and doves in the Cabinet. And yes, this was real Cabinet government, even under Winston Churchill and in the middle of a war.
Having received His Majesty's commission, I have formed an administration of men and women of every party and of almost every point of view. We have differed and quarrelled in the past, but now one bond unites us all, to wage war until victory is won, and never to surrender ourselves to servitude and shame, whatever the cost and the agony may be.
A searchlight just burst into action.
Churchill had formed his coalition government after the House of Commons had effectively dismissed Neville Chamberlain in May of 1940. This brought the Labour Party into the government, together with its 3 principal leaders, Attlee, Morrison, and the lifelong trade union leader, Ernest Bevin, as Minister of Labour. The Lord President of the Council was Sir John Anderson, who had been Governor of Bengal and was also a senior Home Office civil servant during the general strike of 1926. A year before the war, Anderson joined the Conservative government.
As I understand,
Churchill regarded him as sound.
We have a deficiency of, 3.2 million tons of coal, and we've made no allowance for any possible invasion of France. Surely we should proceed with rationing, which would save us...
Friday, 29th May, 1942.
By 1942, Britain's war production was reaching a peak, and the demand for coal had outstripped available supplies.
The administration alone would involve huge numbers of staff.
Then let's look at...
Britain had to produce more coal, but ministers didn't know how.
We must show that the government will not let the industry down after the war. We should be looking at the future of the mining industry as part of our post-war plan.
Certainly miners are a special community. If there's one trade you can pick out from all others, surely mining is that one.
The men who are returning to the mines after rehabilitation will take a while before they can become productive and earn their money. The Board of Trade is keen on an output bonus, but experience is not very encouraging. This is sound in principle, but will take some time to work out.
It was Ernest Bevin who worked out a solution. He used his powers to direct young men into national service by inventing the Bevin Boys. Starting in December 1943, 1 in 10 18-year-olds would be chosen by ballot and conscripted not into the armed services, but into the pits. There was no choice and no appeal.
I know you feel that your duty calls you into one of the fighting services. But believe me, when I say that work in the pits can do just as much to win this war.
3 quid a week, bugger all to eat, army nailed boots and pistols on your feet.
Monday, 15th June, 1942.
The government's representatives in India were becoming increasingly convinced that Gandhi was intent on serious interference with the war effort.
As though day-to-day operational questions were not testing enough, the War Cabinet constantly found itself distracted by its loosening grip in India.
If we need to act against Gandhi, speed is essential. Take him right out of India and quickly when you do, but not prematurely.
The Japanese had occupied Burma, India's neighbour to the east, and the threat of invasion was real. The leaders of India's independence movement were demanding self-government now.
Gandhi will encourage resistance of peasants to any show of force by calling for non-compliance with the salt laws.
Why are we going on with this salt tax in any case? There's very little money in it.
With respect, Prime Minister, the salt tax was 10% of pre-war revenue.
But salt is a universal requirement. It's like taxing air.
The tax on salt, which for centuries had been extracted from the sea and dried by the poorest classes in India, dated back to the rule of the Mughal emperors.
Let's get back to the salt tax. Get rid of it.
In 1930, Gandhi had led a nationwide protest against the tax. It had led to 9 months of violence across almost the whole of India. Gandhi was jailed.
Thursday, August 6th, 1942.
The Secretary of State for India and Burma had telegraphed the Viceroy, suggesting that the government was thinking of deporting Gandhi. Destination?
Probably the best solution is to take him to Aden first, by sea.
I agree, Anderson.
I favour deportation. I don't believe the government of India will be strong enough to hold him if he hunger strikes in custody.
Firstly, you must act. Secondly, this cat-and-mouse game is nonsense. And thirdly, that being so, it's surely better to take him off now, out of it.
Mm. What about the other 15 or 20 leaders?
They don't matter.
As long as you get Gandhi out.
From a publicity point of view, though, it's unwise to isolate him.
Then, Stafford, take half a dozen to Uganda, by air.
And say that we're doing this for the sake of the United Nations, not just Britain.
The issue of what to do with Gandhi was to return over the months that followed.
Thursday, 18th June, 1942.
By the summer of 1942, American troops were arriving in Britain in force, their number limited only by the number of suitable ships.
Lord Leathers, Minister for War Transport.
General Lee is keen on stepping up the numbers of American troops we're carrying.
We'll be 120,000 men short by the end of March. And with more Americans here, we could reduce the shortage by half.
I think the speed of their arrival will have an effect on civil problems. I think it'd be better to have them in steadily.
The only likely bottleneck might be finding them accommodation.
There was a related problem that was to worry the ministers, and many British citizens too, as long as American troops stayed in the country.
The cabinet heard that General Eisenhower was proposing to segregate American colored troops to a limited number of areas, where special arrangements would be made for them. The War Cabinet had before them a memorandum suggesting that British Army personnel should be educated to adopt the same attitude to these coloured troops.
The views of the American Army must be considered. There can be nothing to stand between the American officer and his troops. We mustn't interfere on this.
I accept that, but what I won't have, though, is British police enforcing their rules for them.
I'm against these written instructions.
So am I. Eisenhower's instruction has clearly leaked. Mm. But we can't segregate or discriminate in our canteens.
No.
We could perhaps publish an article on the history of the problem of black soldiers.
Just think about this. At the canteen of Victoria Station, if we conform to these regulations, then coloured troops can't be served.
What would be the effect on our coloured people? Mm. If it can be argued that we've advocated a colour bar, all the coloured people here from our empire will go back discontented and preach disaffection.
I do think we must avoid the term coloured. I believe that the Americans prefer to call them American Negroes.
If there's any segregation, the Americans must do it, not us. We can ask our people to pay attention to it, and certainly there should be a good deal of reserve in the attitude of our troops to Negroes.
Well, educate them by all means, but don't try to educate them into American prejudices.
What about the social side?
I understand there are contingents of Negresses coming to care for them. This is underway, although it is somewhat late in the day.
Friday, 13th November, 1942.
The War Cabinet dealt with a request from Sir William Beveridge to give a press conference on his report.
At the end of 1942, a report that would eventually lead to the welfare state was presented to Parliament. A senior civil servant, William Beveridge, had been commissioned by the government to consider how far the state should go in providing for those in need. By the standards of the day, his report was far-reaching and radical. Churchill, anticipating wide public support for Beveridge's plans, was refusing to be stampeded into implementing them until the war was won.
He's also proposing a conference with lobby correspondents.
But for the moment, it was presentation that worried the cabinet.
Paymaster General?
I saw Beveridge tonight and told him it was improper to discuss the report before his presentation.
He'll spoil it all if he pushes it.
Shouldn't we suspend publication also?
The report is government property. Beveridge must be told he is not to expand on the report to the press. At the same time, we should be defining our attitude to it. Do we like it or not like it? Or haven't we made up our minds about it yet?
The next day, ministers started to formulate a view.
Chancellor, what's the likely cost of all this?
100 million immediately, Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer indicated some dissent.
Generally speaking, I like the report, but we must see how it fits into the post-war plan as a whole. Also, we have to be mindful of our arrangements with the Americans. If we promise this level of largesse far ahead of their standards, then they may well say we're being asked to pay for this.
But surely, Prime Minister, the Americans will be impressed by our boldness.
Quite absolutely. The most serious reaction is on finance. There'll be an effect on taxation.
And there are the other commitments to be considered.
Expenditure on armaments after the war.
We will have a two-stage ending of war. While we finish off Japan after the collapse of Hitler, there'll be an interval during which the United Nations will go forward in companionship. And it is during this period that these plans can be matured.
But when opinion crystallizes, Prime Minister, it is a pity to let it appear that the government dragged its heels and was reluctant to support
it.
Could we not welcome it in principle?
Churchill was resisting any formal commitment now. Later, the question of how far Churchill was willing to go would divide the War Cabinet along party lines.
A British official announcement that Rudolf Hess, the number two choice of Adolf Hitler to head the Nazi regime, is a British prisoner following his...
Wednesday, 14th November, 1942.
Go ahead, London.
Good evening. This is London. Just about an hour ago, number 10 Downing Street released the most incredible story of the war.
Rudolf Hess was one of Hitler's closest associates. His arrival in Scotland, by parachute, from a specially adapted Messerschmitt fighter plane, was a sensation. Under interrogation, Hess claimed that he'd flown to Britain on his own initiative, and that he believed there was an opposition party in England that wanted to make peace and side with Germany in the war against Bolshevism.
The Prime Minister asked for a note to be drafted on the health of Hess.
Churchill's chief concern was to reassure the Russians. Make it clear that if Hess's purpose was to work for a separate peace, Britain would have nothing to do with it.
Make sure that we include a reference to his health and to his fall over the banisters.
There will be a separate statement on that.
Why not say he's on the verge of insanity?
He wasn't when he arrived. We can't say he was.
Well, in that case, add medical report follows and put an addendum. And remember, none of this is for publication. It's for the Russian ambassador and him only. What do you say, Anthony?
Very well, Prime Minister. We'll send it today, saying medical report follows.
The official statement.
On arrival in Scotland, he was physically fit, apart from the breathing.
Hess had been under constant observation by a team of psychiatrists since his arrival in Britain in May.
He had insisted upon having someone to eat with him or else to taste his
food. They found him to be suffering from a paranoid psychosis, subject to hysterical and emotional crises, and the delusions that his food was being poisoned.
And as a result of this increasingly suspicious and paranoid...
The report says that the episode of the banisters mentioned by Churchill in the War Cabinet meeting was a cunningly arranged attempt at suicide.
For that reason, he must be under constant psychiatric and nursing supervision.
So far, the whole story is shrouded in mystery.
We got out of here in a hurry and started to make our way back across the Esplanade. The machine gunner continued his fire, but our luck held out and we made it.
Friday, 9th October, 1942.
Manacling of prisoners of war.
Towards the end of 1942, a new issue came to the surface, that of the treatment of prisoners of war.
The latest German communique is threatening to manacle three times as many British prisoners of war. If this kind of thing is started, there's no knowing where it may stop.
This meeting followed the disastrous raid on Dieppe 2 months earlier, when more than 3,000 Canadians, who'd spent 2.5 years waiting in England for action, were killed, wounded, and captured in a single morning in France. It appeared that during the battle, the Canadians had tied up some German prisoners they'd captured, and that the Germans were retaliating.
How are we treating their POWs?
In the UK, we propose tying 240 during daylight only. They have handcuffs with about a foot of chain, and that is taken off at night.
Well, it's a bad ground to argue on facts.
Well, Prime Minister, in Fleet Street there is a feeling that in an auction of atrocities, Germany would be bound to win.
We've each tied up 1,500. Germany threatens to go up to 5,000. They haven't publicly announced they've done it. There should be no further action from us, therefore, until an official German announcement that they have done so. If they then make a further bid, should we then manacle the same? I would. Then Germany would have to chain another 12,000. Then difficulties would begin to be great. Then we chain 12,000. Then they have to go to 36,000. They find that very hard. Aren't many of the prisoners forced to work?
Yes, Prime Minister, in the mines and on roads.
Well, then Germany would be the end of her tenor after the third round. There'd be no more prisoners left.
We could reserve the right to manacle as many as we like. This would get away from the arithmetical progression.
But then there is a risk of other forms of beastliness. Mm.
We must bear in mind that this may lead to Germany shooting prisoners, and clearly we couldn't follow that example.
I'd shoot in those circumstances.
I doubt if public opinion would support that, Prime Minister.
My instinct is still to say nothing. We should stand where we are. It's clear that Hitler's order is being questioned in official circles in Germany. He's in a difficult position. He can only escape by enlarging the area of controversy.
As Churchill had hoped, and with the help of the Swiss, both sides pulled back and the crisis was resolved. Meanwhile, Churchill was looking ahead to the end of the war and the fate of the Nazi leaders.
The idea of my paper is that you don't pass judgment, but collect facts in an authoritative manner. It's important to make a big show of them. Publish evidence from time to time to hot up the fires of war. I propose a fact-finding commission, flourish of trumpets, and then I believe that Washington will take the initiative.
A similar committee was appointed in September 1914. But it contained no names of offenders.
It is my view, Lord Chancellor, that we should consider names now. If Hitler falls into our hands, we will most certainly put him to death. After all, he's not a sovereign who could be said to be in the hands of his ministers, like the Kaiser was.
I think the phrase, taking depositions and interrogating eyewitnesses, needs revision, Prime Minister. And also some of the names on the committee you have suggested.
There must be an official body appointed by government.
Well, we can set up a committee to work out the details of both papers. But we must remember that Hitler is the mainspring of evil. The instrument I would propose is the electric chair, like the one they use for gangsters in America. That will no doubt be available on lease lend.
Was that serious? Or was it a black joke? Mr. Brooks' notes don't record laughter, so we don't know.
Monday, 14th December, 1942.
The Cabinet discussed this morning reports of the mass execution of Jews in Poland. It was said that Jews were being transferred there from enemy-occupied countries, and it was thought that these transfers were being made with a view to extermination.
Is there any confirmation, Foreign Secretary?
on the story of this wholesale massacre by mass electrical methods?
Nothing direct, Prime Minister, but there are indications that it may be true, although at the moment we can't confirm the method. We do know that Jews are being taken from Norway and sent to Poland, evidently for some such purposes.
Who knew what and how much, and when ministers knew it, there have never been clear answers to that. The existence of Hitler's concentration camps was known by about 1935, but that was before some of them became death camps. In June of 1942, a Polish courier described massacres in the east of up to 700,000 people, but he was told by a British journalist to drop a zero or two if he wanted to be believed. By early December, though, British newspapers were printing more and more reports of atrocities against Jews.
There's been a joint declaration between Britain, America, and Russia, probably for issue on Thursday. This commits us to punishing those responsible for these outrages.
2 days after this meeting, Eden made a statement to the Commons about the massacre of Jews. The whole House rose and stood for a minute's silence.
Monday, 22nd February, 1943.
I have a report on the recent meeting concerning Jewish refugees. There's been no progress with the United States.
The War Cabinet was also exercised by the problem of resettling Jewish refugees. At one meeting, the Cabinet agreed to allowing 500 Jews who'd escaped from Bulgaria to go on to Palestine. But this was exceptional.
Home Secretary?
I could take 1,000 or so Jews as part of any international moves, but only to encourage other countries to do the same.
But can we really continue to pretend in the House of Commons that we are holding international conversations?
My feeling is that we've done too much already. There's a danger of anti-Semitic troubles here.
It isn't a cup final because these people are taking shelter, and I must say,
Monday, 8th March, 1943.
The Home Secretary referred to the incident in Bethnal Green Tube Station last Wednesday night.
Gentlemen, let's look at where we are so far.
When 180 people have been crushed to death in the entrance.
An announcement on the fatalities was held up for some hours, and a statement containing the facts of the incident was released after consultation with the Prime Minister. However, people in the vicinity are worried, and there are calls for a public inquiry. I fear that there could be an adverse effect on the public morale of continued publicity of this incident.
Clearly, it should not be held in public.
The full story of the disaster at Bethnal Green was withheld until after the war. It happened during an air raid on London when a crowd, alarmed by the unfamiliar noise of an experimental anti-aircraft rocket, dashed for shelter to the tube station. The entrance and the stairs were narrow, and people tripped over one another. A London magistrate held a closed inquiry.
Two aspects concern me, the physical and the psychological. The more we stress the second, the greater the security risk. We have therefore altered the report's language, but we must give a fair picture.
I remain against publication. We're flaunting our weakest feature. And this is meat and drink to the enemy.
With respect, Prime Minister, 180 people were killed. It shook the public. We had to hold an inquiry, and there was much agitation against it being private, and we said that the report would be published. Now people will say we've got something to hide.
Why on earth should we publish? Previously we said there was no panic. The report makes it clear that there was panic, and it was partly the cause of the tragedy, and this we are withholding.
An official announcement from Washington about 2 hours ago shows that the Americans have made landings at Algiers and Oran on the Mediterranean coast of French North Africa, as well as at places on the Atlantic coast of Morocco. The American landings were carried out in force during the night. They were made with British naval...
Wednesday, 3rd March, 1943.
Item 1. General de Gaulle's request to visit North Africa.
This is troublesome.
The Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs.
There is no ideal solution.
Selborne?
In my view, we really must maintain our non-de Gaulle contacts, the ones which he wants us to repudiate.
America and Britain had invaded French North Africa 4 months earlier without involving or informing the man who regarded himself, not without cause, as the only leader of Free France. Roosevelt disliked de Gaulle. Their antipathy was mutual, and Roosevelt was backing de Gaulle's chief rival, General Giraud. The Brooke notebooks show that when de Gaulle announced that he wanted to visit French troops in North Africa, Churchill was afraid the two generals, rivals, would inevitably quarrel.
We can't acquiesce in de Gaulle's seducing French troops from their allegiance to Giraud. But without the help and goodwill of the Americans, our power to carry on the war would be gravely hampered. In the long run, France can only be liberated by Anglo-American blood, which will flow in ever-broadening streams as the campaign develops. Respond to de Gaulle like this. Tell him that at this stage in relations, it is not considered desirable that he should leave the country.
There will probably be trouble here. His reputation is higher than ever.
Put it quite bluntly and arrest him if he tries to leave, for instance, by a French destroyer. Security measures should be laid on to prevent that. Agreed.
Les leçons de ces malheurs. Et bientôt, soyons-en sûrs.
A few days later, de Gaulle went public. He told British newspapers that Giraud's activities in North Africa were an infraction of French sovereignty.
He wants the title deeds of France in his pocket. Giraud is a much better man, and de Gaulle probably is a bitter enemy of Great Britain.
But remember, Prime Minister, that the name de Gaulle stands throughout France as the spirit of resistance.
It seems to me that the greatest living barrier to reunion and restoration of France is insensate ambition.
Thursday, 7th January, 1943.
It is very dangerous to yield to a hunger strike.
The War Cabinet was still wrestling with the problem of what to do with Gandhi in India, who repeatedly was threatening to starve himself.
We give him no rules about food. Then I would see it through. This is what I did with the Indians in Bengal. I made it clear that they were responsible. Then, well, let him starve.
He is such a semi-religious figure that his death in our hands would be a great blow and an embarrassment.
Let him out as an act of state rather than an act of submission to Gandhi's will.
The medical opinion is that he will die in 3 days. The only question is where he dies.
Frankly, I'd keep him there, let him do as he likes. If you're going to let him out, then let him out now. We've detained him for 6 months and we've beaten him.
Churchill suspected that the attentions of Gandhi's lady devotees would save him from an untimely death. Under a new viceroy, and amid reports that he had malaria, Gandhi was released in 1944, rising from his sickbed in apparently perfect health, as his acolyte sang, "Lead Kindly Light."
Monday, 5th February, 1943.
The last general election had been in 1936, and Parliament was in its 8th year, its life extended by the war.
The War Cabinet resumed their discussion of the line to be taken by the government spokesman in the forthcoming debate on the Beveridge Report.
Here was an occasion when Churchill and his leading Labour ministers differed quite sharply. In a broadcast speech, Churchill had publicly endorsed the main Beveridge proposals, but in Cabinet he remained adamantly opposed to any government action on the plan until after the war. He was reluctant to agree even to preparation in the form of an enabling bill, since it might imply total commitment.
The Prime Minister's memo sets it out clearly. There will either be no enabling legislation at all, or this question of social security will be given a lower priority than other projects.
But in the last war, the education bill was passed by an even older Parliament. Yeah. If the Prime Minister persists with this line, it will provoke demands for a general election.
We don't accept any commitment at the moment.
Gentlemen, It's impossible to foresee the international situation after the war.
But you can't make plans even without reaching some decisions.
Our first promise, Mr. Attlee, should be to ensure that the demobilized will get back to their own jobs. But of course, every conceivable preparation will be made.
But preparations all involve decisions of policy. Yes.
The question we have to address now is whether we shall legislate on this subject during the course of this Parliament.
I would agree to legislation by this Parliament to prepare for post-war, but not to legislation taking decisions binding us to the future.
But if we accept the view that we can have no enabling legislation dealing with post-war problems, we shall be in an indefensible position.
Yeah, I don't mean to ban legislation enabling you to make preparations, Mr. Morrison.
But no legislation at all on social security assigns it to the lowest priority.
Well, get the bills drafted. But I'm uneasy about the extent to which we are drifting away from our constitutional obligations to the electorate.
The report proposes an all-in scheme of medical treatment of all kinds for all citizens.
When the House of Commons debated the Beveridge report later that month, Labour backbenchers did indeed revolt against what they called the coalition's reluctance to implement the reforms. It was an invidious position not only for Attlee as Labour Party leader and simultaneously Churchill's deputy, but also for Ernest Bevin and Herbert Morrison, who wanted a firm commitment to a post-war welfare state as set out by Beveridge. Back to the War Cabinet.
The temper of the meeting this morning was very unsatisfactory.
The main point is the delay in promoting legislation.
Agreed. There is an inference that legislation will be delayed.
Yeah, I didn't say so. I said we'd go on as fast as we could. Chancellor.
The position is that immediately after today's debate, we will begin discussions with interested parties about the proposed National Medical Service. Then, when preparations have been made, the government will review the other claims and resume consideration of the financial position. And that's what every government does before introducing a bill. What's wrong with that?
I agree. Has the time come to form a government concerned with matters other than the prosecution of the war? Without a general election?
I didn't come into this government, Prime Minister, on the basis only of dealing with war. I always understood that we would concern ourselves with preparations for post-war problems.
Yes.
Moreover, the public are very much interested in their post-war conditions. This government must either govern, or we get through a general election and find a government that will.
We risk a peril to financial security through irresponsible commitments. We must get our soldiers home and into employment, Mr. Attlee. I'm not fighting this issue on a no-mandate basis.
The Labour Party is not irresponsible about this.
Everyone wants it, but can you pay for it? You can't pass the bill before you know where you are.
If we say there is going to be no legislation until after the war, the House of Commons won't have it. This is a political crisis. There's a solid Labour vote in favour of the motion table.
Yeah, exactly.
I must ascertain the views of the Tory party.
If this government leaves its successor with no legislative preparation for the post-war period, we shall be treacherous to the country.
Whoever is responsible on the day when Germany is beaten should have the power to decide.
A general election at this stage of the war is surely unthinkable. Certainly it wasn't something Attlee, Bevin and the other Labour leaders could have welcomed. To the country at large, Churchill was still indispensable in 1943. And so, of course, was his personal relationship with Roosevelt.
Roosevelt's inclined to let our troops shoot them out of hand. I suggested we draw up a list of 50 or so who would be declared as outlaws. Those not on the list might be induced to rat.
The discussion in the War Cabinet centered on the draft proposals for dealing with the principal Nazi leaders.
The nearest officer of brigade rank should call a military court to establish his identity and then execute him without higher authority.
Prime Minister, remember that an earlier public declaration by the Allies states that there should be provision for their surrender. Roosevelt has signed this.
Yes, well, my scheme would be a refinement on that.
The concern is not so much about Hitler and Mussolini, but about the smaller men who've done bestial things.
It is premature to take any action. The time is not ripe, even for a private warning.
is a significant gap in the Brook notebooks, an interval between July 1943 and April 1945, when he left the Cabinet Office to do other work at the new Ministry of Reconstruction. Curiously, nobody appears to have taken up his apparently self-appointed task of summarising what individual ministers were saying and recording their remarks in his notebooks. Do you pay a visit?
Yes, I did. I can't say that it was totally...
Thursday, 12th April, 1945.
It was not until the very last days of the war that Brook returned to his post at the War Cabinet.
Mr. Attlee gave the War Cabinet an account of his recent visit to France and the Low Countries.
Holland is free. Flooded, but free. We hope to close the gaps by November. Then they can pump out the water. Then we hope to sow rye for 1946 and get the land into good heart in 2 years.
It is extremely valuable to have this first-hand knowledge, Clem. See any cattle?
No, they lock them up in Holland.
The Cabinet's mood, when we reach 1945, seems much more relaxed than it appears to have been during the tense years of 1942 and 43. By now, the fighting in Europe was nearly over. And surprisingly, the Allies had still not agreed what to do with Hitler and his accomplices. All British ministers had before them was a proposal.
It all seems very good.
No, I disagree with the proposal. It mixes political and judicial decisions with disadvantage to both. It'll mean no real trial for Hitler, giving him no facilities to argue. Not being a proper trial, it will give him a chance to harangue. This is neither a proper trial nor a political act. It is the worst of both worlds.
Well, I believe all the major allies are committed to the execution of Hitler. This mock trial is objectionable. It's far better to declare now that we shall put them to death.
I agree. The trial will be a farce. They should be treated as outlaws.
But, Prime Minister, it depends entirely into whose hands Hitler falls.
This is London calling. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead. I repeat that.
A fortnight later, on April the 30th, as the Red Army was advancing on his bunker in Berlin, Hitler shot himself.
Some parts of larger Germany would bloom if it wasn't for the heavy burdens being laid on them by the Russians.
Norman Brook's notebooks now record the final meetings of the War Cabinet, with debates on reparations and the dismantling of German industry.
Russia will crush the East to peasant level. In the West, we can't level...
Churchill, already afraid that the rate of the Red Army's advance would give Stalin control of Eastern Europe, was also worrying about the scale of Russian demands for reparations in Germany. These included the machinery and fittings from entire factories in what would become the British occupation zone, and this raised the prospect of high unemployment, a food crisis, and not least, a huge bill to be paid by Britain's taxpayers.
It sounds as if our occupation zone turns into a vast soup kitchen.
But Germany, in economic dissolution and semi-starvation, will eventually command world compassion.
Meanwhile, the Americans are acting. They've seized German patents and are already negotiating. We really should do the same.
Dismemberment may prove impracticable. My personal view is isolate Prussia, because historically they have been the cause of all the trouble.
The German command agrees to the surrender of all German armed forces in Holland.
Unlike the First World War, when the guns fell silent at 11 o'clock on the 11th day of the 11th month, victory in Europe was untidy. Britain's General Montgomery took the first surrender of the Germans. America's General Eisenhower took another surrender several days later, and Stalin insisted on a third ceremony to be attended by Western commanders in Berlin. In Britain, meanwhile, crowds were anticipating an official announcement that the war was over.
Monday, 7th May, 1945.
The Prime Minister informed the War Cabinet that at 2:41 that morning, General Eisenhower had received the unconditional surrender...
Right at the last minute, the Allies couldn't coordinate the peace.
Eisenhower proposed yesterday to make the public announcement of the end of hostilities at 3 p.m. on the 8th of May. I telegraphed to Truman and Uncle Joe to synchronize times. Uncle Joe accepted. Then Eisenhower said he couldn't wait till then. So I suggested 6 p.m. today. Truman replied, indicating he couldn't agree unless Uncle Joe did. I hope the War Cabinet will agree.
What about working people?
Could we say, Announcement at 3 p.m. and no need to go to work. Tomorrow, Tuesday, will be treated as Victory in Europe Day and will be regarded as a holiday. The press can leak that in the morning.
An official announcement will be broadcast by the Prime Minister at 3 o'clock tomorrow, Tuesday afternoon.
It comes into view, then the King standing on the balcony, listen to the crowd.
Norman Brook's notebooks actually continue until 1947, covering the first years of the Attlee government and the beginning of the welfare state based on those Beveridge proposals. But in the summer of 1945, he took a clean page of his notebook and wrote,
"The last meeting of the caretaker government was held on the 24th of July, 1945. On the 26th of July, 1945, the results of the general election were declared. Mr. Churchill resigned, and Mr. Attlee was invited to form a government."
And with that, Norman Brook took a ruler and drew two straight lines with his fountain pen.